This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. One of the biggest policy questions of the year, reauthorizing New Hampshire's Medicaid expansion program, was approved by the state Senate yesterday after nearly 3 hours of debate. Republicans who were opposed said the program discourages work, but Democrats like Lou D'Alessandro disagreed.
I find that objectionable, and I will not accept that. These are good, hardworking people. They need help. In order to work, you need insurance.
Now that the bill is passed, Governor Hassan promises to sign it. Meanwhile, this week, the race to replace Hassan as governor got more crowded. On Wednesday, State Senator Jeanne Forrester became the fourth Republican to run.
I do support the Second Amendment, and I believe we need to preserve and protect those Second Amendment rights. I also believe we need to protect the life of the unborn child. And finally, I will absolutely take the pledge against the sales and income tax, period.
Forrester spoke on WMUR-TV. And there's another gubernatorial contender who also announced his intentions, Democrat and former Portsmouth Mayor Steve Marchand, who said he'd be drawing on his background in politics and as a business consultant.
There's a humility that's required to be a really good governor, and it means that you have to be willing to admit you don't know everything on day one. Nobody's an expert on everything, and it means you've got to ask big questions, listen to the people who are living it every day, analyze, listen, learn, decide, and then lead.
Also this week, a state commission approved a plan for around-the-clock coverage at the State Division of Children, Youth, and Families. But DCYF caseworker Demetrio Soros worried the plan will further strain an already depleted staff.
Taking a system that is already struggling to handle the workload of Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and asking that it cover the state 24/7 is not going to make children more safe.
The plan comes in response to the deaths of two young children and includes hiring 18 new child protective workers. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover some of the top stories around the state this week. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Casey McDermott, digital reporter for us here at NHPR. Casey, welcome back.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Gary, thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura. It's good to be here.
Well, all of you, let's turn very quickly to the Medicaid vote. The vote was 16-8, so only six Republicans supported the bill, but Dean Spiliotis, including two important members of the Senate, Chuck Morse, Jeb Bradley, what do you make of the partisanship of this vote on Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, you know, this has been a really interesting political issue to watch, and we really have been watching it since the very beginning when the Medicaid expansion first went under discussion a couple years ago, and there was a lot of pushback from Republicans in the state legislature about not having a program that was simply what they viewed as kind of a federal handout. They wanted to kind of shift it a little bit to have more of a kind of a private insurance feel to it, have people buy their insurance off of the exchanges. And so all along, that's kind of been the debate, is to have something that is palatable for Republicans to support, while at the same time recognizing that there are now almost 50,000 people on this program. We've talked about how it's also helped people who are struggling with opioid and heroin addiction because of some of the funding of treatment options. So there's really a lot of pressure to get this through. The hitch now is going to be this clause about work and whether or not you can require people to work. The feds have not approved it in the past. And we'll see what happens. But, you know, we've said before, once you get this many people on the program, it's very difficult not to re-up it.
Well, and just remind us, Casey, if you could, please, how this bill that passed the House and the Senate is different from the way that the program is running right now.
Right. So right now there aren't any kind of work requirements incorporated into the Medicaid expansion as a condition of coverage. But under the new proposal to be eligible, there's a clause in there that someone must spend at least 30 hours a week on work, training, community service. There's a few other categories in there. And those are actually modeled after the temporary assistance for needy families criteria. And at the beginning of this whole debate earlier this year, the Senator Bradley and others who were kind of crafting this proposal said that they were optimistic that by using that criteria, it might help them in terms of getting the feds to approve it, because the feds have been reluctant to do so with other states who have requested those requirements.
So there's a work requirement, but there's also something, Casey, called severability.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the issue is that, you know, should the federal government not approve that, what happens to the program? And that was a big part of the debate here, was that, you know, there were some people who felt really strongly that those work requirements had to be in there, no exceptions. But then others who were worried that, well, you know, we can't let this whole program fall apart if the federal government doesn't approve this. And there is a severability clause in there that or there's, you know, as the bill passed, the program would not necessarily end if the federal government did not approve those requirements.
And Gary, you were at the State House during this whole debate. You've been covering this for several years now. What jumped out at you, Gary, from being there at the, you know, the final moment?
Well, there are a couple things that jumped out. I mean, one is there's a lot of animosity among Republicans. I mean, this was a debate among Republicans that we had yesterday. I mean, there were only you had the clip of Lou going off about the work state workers and don't demean them, and then Jeff Woodburn, who's the Democratic leader, gets up basically and says, "Great, this is, you know, this is the way we should be working here," and so on. And but it really is a debate among Republicans, and it was a kind of, got down into the trenches in a big way in a lot of ways. I mean, you could see the real divide there. There are the Republicans that say, well, you know, this is nothing but a handout. We really need to have, like, the work requirements in X, Y, and Z. We don't know what the results are, all that. And the others that saying, hey, it works. I mean, it's got broad support across the spectrum. We've got 50,000 people that are covered. We have reductions in uncompensated care from the providers. And, you know, it's kept a lid on it. We haven't used any new taxes or new fees or whatever. I mean, we have, I suppose the biggest difference is that the federal government isn't paying 100% anymore after the end of this year. And so they have the hospitals and the insurance companies kicking in about $40 million over the next 2 years.
Covering that gap.
They're covering the 5% that the state is obligated for.
Well, it's interesting what you say, Gary, and you alluded to this too, Dean, this debate among Republicans about what to do with this. We got a sense of that earlier this week on The Exchange. We had two key Senate leaders, both Republicans, in talking about this. Let's hear a little bit from Andy Sanborn, Republican senator from Bedford. He said the real problem is that we've been unable to bring down the incredibly high cost of health care so it's affordable for all. He said that's really the problem we should be looking at. And he objected to the extension of Medicaid beyond its traditional recipients. Let's hear.
We're just going to go spend literally $1 billion to give free health care to just 40,000 people solely because we can't solve the other problems, and specifically to a group of people who are able-bodied and just not working full-time. I mean, look, I'm incredibly proud of the fact this state has always stood up and provided health care to people who are sick and were poor or were broke. That's an obligation. It's something we should do in our state, and we've always done it. We're now walking into an entirely new realm of government services and benefits where we're now providing a benefit to people who actually aren't sick. We're just giving them free health care.
So, Casey McDermott, able-bodied, that was a word that I heard a lot in this debate.
Yeah, and actually, just to kind of put this into context, there's been a lot of talk about all these people are unemployed, they're not working. According to the data from the state, actually, as of January, there was a divide of about 43% of the people on the program were employed and about 57% were unemployed. So just to kind of give some more data on that. But yeah, there's, you know, I think that's a lot of the same debates that you hear in coverage in debates over just healthcare coverage generally. It's that, you know, we don't want to give handouts to people who don't need it. But I think that, you know, what we've heard from a lot of the people who have been enrolled in the program is that, you know, there's people who were maybe self-employed and their businesses were not doing so well and they didn't necessarily want to be enrolled in the program, but this was just kind of like a bridge until they got back on their feet. So I think there's a lot of like nuances in terms of the people who are actually covered on it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, go ahead,
Dean. I was going to say, you know, following up on this, there are two narratives I hear a lot from conservatives. You spend a little time listening to conservative talk radio and you hear it all the time. One is that that this feeds into people who know how to game the system, who don't really deserve the benefits but figured out how to receive them anyway. And the second narrative I hear is that this is all just a slippery slope to a single-payer, nationalized healthcare system, that they're going to keep defining this more broadly and broadly and broadly until we eventually have a federally controlled system. So there are a lot of passions among conservatives about this. You know, Republicans who support this have said, you know, if the money's not there in 2 years, we'll let it sunset. Well, then you're 4 years down the road. You know, who knows how many people will be enrolled in this program. I don't know how you're going to let it sunset in 2 years just because the money shifts a little bit and we're going to end up having this debate all over again.
One of the other things that kept coming up with this, and I'm sure you heard this too, Dean, is yes, we know the work requirements aren't set in stone. That was some of the problem that Republicans like Andy Sanborn said, you know, if the federal government says no, the program continues. And based on a lot of reporting out there, it looks like the federal government will not approve these work requirements. Senator Jeb Bradley, who also appeared in our program, said, yes, I favor the work requirements. And by the way, we're going to have a new administration coming into the White House next year. So maybe they will approve the work requirements. But Senator Bradley, many times on our program, made the point that Medicaid expansion right now is playing an important role in the opioid crisis. Let's hear him making that point.
We have almost 40% of our substance abuse funding coming from this program. That's 6,000 people that have accessed this benefit. So, you know, I get the qualms that people might have about it, but the program is working. If we don't reauthorize it, health insurance rates are going to soar. And what happens to the 6,000 people or more in the middle of a heroin crisis?
Again, that's Senator Jeb Bradley talking about Medicaid expansion on our program earlier this week. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Gary, since we heard from Senator Bradley there talking about money for the opioid epidemic, I wanted to ask you about another financial aspect of this fight against drugs, especially opioids like heroin and fentanyl. This has been front and center all legislative season. The governor and lawmakers this week, Gary, finally agreed on spending $5 million more to address this. Where's this money going to go, Gary?
Well, that's a good question. And we had a very lengthy debate about it in the Senate. You know, the whole, it's sort of like the Democrats and Republicans were saying, are you serious enough? Are you serious enough about this? What we're really talking about is Governor Hassan wanted $5 million more to go to the Governor's Commission on Alcohol, Drugs, et cetera, for treatment programs. And that was part of this bill. And what originally came out of the House, Senate Finance Committee was $2.5 million. And there was another bill for $2 million for housing for people in recovery. And so they said, well, we will give you $2.5 million out of basically your budget, Health and Human Services, but you decide where it goes. And there was another part, which is a new drug prosecutor in the Attorney General's office, and they said, we'll give you that too, but that's got to come out of your budget. We're not going to give you any more money. Well, then,
and where do the Democrats want the money to come from?
They wanted the money to come from the $60 million surplus, revenue surplus that's out there. So when we get on the floor, all of a sudden now there's a new proposal. It's $4.5 million, and the rest of it's pretty much the same. But they say instead of coming from your budget, it's coming from surplus throughout state government, which there is some serious money available for the charters from the charter schools program because there are not enough kids in it. So it's a lot more money than they need. And there's also the school education aid program has more money than it needs. So there's some of those places like that where there's piles of money. And they said, well, let the governor decide where it comes from. We'll get it out there. It'll start up by the July. We'll have all the money out there. And then Democrats are saying, well, let's fully fund it. We got $60 million in new revenue that we weren't counting on. So let's fund it that way. So this was a big fight.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, when they take the vote on the bill, it's 24-0. So everybody's kumbaya.
A long road to the kumbaya moment. Yeah. Right. Okay. So the $5 million will go to the commission.
Not all of it will go to the – still, we're going to leave it up to the Health and Human Services commissioner to decide whether it will go to the housing or the treatment program.
Well, and another drug policy effort, Casey, I wanted to ask you about, a bill to extend the prescription drug take-back program to illegal substances like heroin. Just remind us what a take-back program is.
Right. So basically, this is where, a police department might have like a box at the station or some kind of designated area where people who have extra prescription drugs, maybe they got more than they needed for a certain procedure, something like that, they can bring the drugs there, kind of no questions asked, and just get rid of them. And this is a big issue because what you'll hear from a lot of people who are following kind of the opioid epidemic or just other drug issues is that oftentimes, if there's extra prescription drugs laying around the house, that can make it easier for teens in particular to kind of get their hands on them or just other people in general who might, wanting to use them or to experiment with them. So just getting them out of the house is good, and having a safe place to do that is important from a public health standpoint. So right now that only applies to legal drugs, prescription drugs. The proposal on the table now would extend that to drug paraphernalia and illicit drugs like heroin, cocaine, fentanyl. And according to the Associated Press, at a hearing earlier this week, there was some concern raised by members of law enforcement that this bill might have unintended consequences, that it could open up the door for kind of legalizing the possession of illicit drugs and helping people to kind of, just return the drugs if there may be dealers or other people who are actively involved in kind of the distribution of illegal substances. And it's interesting because a lot of the debate that you're hearing on this is kind of similar to what we've been hearing on the needle exchange bill, which is a similar kind of setup where it's supposed to be this mechanism for getting rid of these things that are allowing people to continue their addiction or to continue their, their use of drugs. But it's that balance between how do you balance enforcement with these kinds of public health concerns that come along with the proposal.
That's interesting. So the concern by law enforcement was, look, if we're on the brink of arresting someone for being a dealer and all of a sudden he or she says, hey, I want to bring back all my drugs, then there's no evidence to prosecute that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think we're going to hear a lot more debate on this moving forward from both sides.
Gary, has anybody tried this before? Well, I know the take-back programs are popular, but
The Gloucester, Mass. Police Department has been doing this for a while, which is basically they said, bring all your drugs here, turn them in, we won't do anything.
No matter what kind.
We'll have somebody here who can help you.
Wow.
And so that's basically the same sort of program. That's what that's based on. He's been doing that for about a year now.
Yeah, that program got some national attention in terms of just being this kind of, a new way of thinking for law enforcement to act as this kind of bridge for people to get help instead of just, thinking about, if I try to get rid of these, I might risk being, being penalized. So.
And this hearing was kind of interesting, and it showed you the real kind of give and take between law enforcement and health issues. I mean, and that's a real problem, and it's not easily resolved, and that became very obvious here.
So a new role for law enforcement in this crisis.
No matter what, it was Chief Profonsky from Bedford who was saying, basically, you've committed a crime, and so you can't get off scot-free, And then you have these other people who are saying, yeah, but it's not a criminal issue. It's really a health issue, and we need to be able to overlook that to get these people the help they need. And here we are. I mean, it's a big debate, and it's going to keep going on.
Well, there was another bill toward that end that brings up some similar issues that we'll talk about in just a moment. Also, another huge topic this week, child protection and the state's role. And a little bit later, we'll look at that very crowded race for New Hampshire governor. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we catch up on some of the major Granite State stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com, and Casey McDermott, digital reporter for us here at NHPR. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Just to wrap up our conversation about all these bills and all these efforts aimed at the state's opioid epidemic, there's one more bill I want to ask you all about. A bill to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. Now, this is in the works. It could have a tough time becoming law. But, Casey, there's another effort to not decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana, but pull back a bit on the penalties associated with possession, again, for small amounts. So how would this work, Casey?
Sure. So according to reporting from Josh Rogers at NHPR earlier this week, this bill would treat the possession of an ounce or less of marijuana, as a violation. And so it would be a simple misdemeanor rather than a Class A misdemeanor. So that's lighter penalties, not quite as severe. And what's interesting here is that it's actually this is being seen as kind of a compromise between the people who are pushing for this and the law enforcement community, who has traditionally been more kind of resistant to any changes in the state's kind of drug penalties around marijuana. So I think that it'll be interesting to see if this actually moves forward, because in the past, proposals to decriminalize marijuana even further have stalled.
Well, and here's a little piece of sound from a member of the law enforcement community, as you said, Casey, testifying in favor of this. Here's the New Hampshire Association of Police Chiefs president, Robert Cormier, talking to the House committee, saying this proposal will give judges, as you said, Casey, more latitude to treat marijuana possession as a violation, but not going all the way to decriminalize it. Let's hear.
We think it accomplishes the same goal without sending out a message to teens that it's not a crime anymore. What we didn't want to do was send out a message to the youth that it's the same thing as a stop sign violation.
So what do you think, Dean Spiliotis? You know, law enforcement, as Casey said, has been leery of these drug decriminalization efforts, and especially legalization. But here's an attempt to reach some middle ground.
Yeah, and this speaks to Gary's comments before the break about this new role that law enforcement find themselves thrust into, having to kind of deal with the, you know, society's changing views about what constitutes drug crimes versus addiction and health issues. And on top of that, you know, we're talking about opioid and heroin, you know, marijuana is somewhat of a separate issue with increasingly liberal views on that. I think a majority of New Hampshireites certainly favored decriminalization, if not legalization. And again, decrim is just sort of reducing the penalties below an ounce or a half ounce, as opposed to full legalization where you could go in and buy it in a neighborhood store. So I think it really speaks to that. You know, I think this is a way for law enforcement to feel like they're not totally ceding the issue, because a judge will have latitude to decide what kind of violation it is. But it is sort of like a baby step or an incremental step towards perhaps eventual decriminalization. Although, you know, as we said earlier, that keeps passing the House and failing in the Senate. This bill, I believe, actually passed the Senate.
It
started in the Senate. So we may actually have a better chance of getting this.
The whole issue here really is to give kids an opportunity. I mean, if you get charged with a misdemeanor these days, that's going to follow you all the way through. If you're trying to sign up for the military, you get into college for college scholarships and so on, that's on your record. If it's down to a violation, which it can be pleaded down to with the way it's set up now for a simple misdemeanor, then that's not going to follow somebody's record. So they'll be able to get into the military. They'll be able to get the college scholarships, et cetera.
Well, as we look at the state's opioid addiction epidemic, this is a topic that everybody running for New Hampshire governor says that they will tackle head on. And boy, Dean, the New Hampshire governor's race is getting more interesting, getting more crowded as people who follow politics. Yeah. We love that. Two entrants this week. And let's talk about the Republicans first, Dean.
Sure.
Jeanie Forrester made a highly anticipated announcement on Wednesday. We played a little clip of her at the beginning of our show. Who is Jeanie Forrester and where does she fit into this field?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that this is an increasingly crowded field. We've got four Republicans and three Democrats. Politicians love an open seat. You see this all the time when an incumbent yields their seat either through term limits or retirement or to run for another office. So, you know, Jeanie Forrester is well known to people who follow state legislative politics. She's a chair of the Senate Finance Committee, obviously a Republican. It's going to run kind of as a fiscal conservative with a lot of experience in state fiscal matters. So, you know, she joins, an increasingly crowded field that on the Republican side that includes Ted Gatzis, mayor of Manchester, Chris Sununu, the executive counselor of the Sununu family, and Frank Edelblut, who is sort of a kind of a conservative slash libertarian, fairly new, I think, first term representative as well. So it's going to be a really interesting race on the Republican side. You know, for me, the interesting thing to see is whether or not this governor's race kind of gets lost in the mix between a big presidential race and a really big Senate race between Governor Hassan and Kelly Ayotte. So, you know, traditionally on the ballot, the governor is the second race listed, but that Senate race is going to be huge. The presidential race is going to be huge. So in the midst of all that, we're going to have seven people competing to be governor.
Gary, you've watched Senator Forrester as chair of the Senate Finance Committee, as Dean said. What can you tell us about her?
Well, I think, you know, she is trying to position herself to the right of Sununu and Gatzis. And you know, that being said, and take the Trump phenomenon into consideration, this is the year of the outsider. She's a woman. She's conservative. So I think she's playing that card, saying, I'm different. I'm not part of this game. I'm not part of this establishment long like Sununu and Gatzis are. I mean, but she's been in the Senate for 6 years, so she is a bit tied in. I mean, a typical example was the Medicaid vote. 2 years ago, she voted in favor of it. And yesterday, she voted against it, saying she couldn't vote for it as long as there was no real work requirement in it. You know, and her position, I mean, she talks about limited government, personal responsibility, Second Amendment rights. She's pro-life and no broad-based taxes. I mean, that's pretty typical of a Republican running for governor.
So she's carving out that conservative wing.
Conservative wing of the field, yeah.
Well, and on the Democratic side, Steve Marchand jumped in on Thursday. And I guess I'll turn to you again, Dean. Who is Steve Marchand and what does he bring to the table?
Steve is a former mayor of Portsmouth. He comes out of sort of a consulting kind of business background, fairly young. Some people say he was waiting to see what Stephanie Shaheen was going to do, whether she was going to run for governor from the Seacoast. You know, he's flirted with running for public office before. He's kind of someone I've seen around Democratic politics for a while. You know, pretty experienced, polished guy. I think a number of people were kind of surprised to see him finally jump in. But, you know, I think he'll make it an interesting race with the other two who are also, sort of pretty well known in Democratic circles.
I think he's more out of the like Shaheen Lynch mode than Van Ostern and Connolly is. I think he's more looking at kind of the middle of the road.
Rather than the progressive wing
of the party.
Mark Connolly being the former Bureau of Securities Regulations head
director.
Of that and a businessman and Colin Van Ostern,
who is
executive counselor and also with experience in business.
He's been a political operative for both the Shaheen when she was running for Senate, for Annie Custer when she was running for the Congress.
And what's so interesting about this on the Democratic side is, you know, we had Jean Shaheen as governor. We had John Lynch, Maggie Hassan, progressives in the Democratic Party in the state who are sort of emboldened by the success of Bernie Sanders here have been increasingly kind of chomping at the bit for a more progressive Democratic candidate. Now, that may they would, I think, ideally like that to include some sort of broad-based revenue tax. That's probably not going to happen. But nonetheless, in the past, I've sort of seen this wing of the party kind of sort of hold their tongue when, you know, John Lynch is the only Democrat to win re-election in 2010 practically. But maybe now it might be different. So it is going to be interesting to see Marchand try to fill that other part of the Democratic spectrum.
Casey, you want to jump in?
Yeah, actually, on that issue, I would recommend anyone who wants to kind of explore that a little bit more. My colleague Sam Evans Brown did a really good piece right after the primary, just looking at kind of whether Bernie Sanders' large margin here might have any impact on the state level races. And there's some interesting comments in there from Democrats who've been involved in state politics for some time, kind of speculating that that might cause the kind of shifts that Dean was talking about in terms of leading into the governor's race.
Well, and again, all these candidates say they will focus heavily on the opioid crisis. Jeanie Forster, we didn't mention, does have experience as a substance abuse counselor at a place for teenagers who are struggling with addiction. So she said she'll bring that to the table. Speaking of children and their struggles, I did want to ask you, Casey McDermott, about another huge topic this week, child protection and the state's role. The House Committee on Children and Family Law is looking at three bills. It seems to me, Casey, all aimed at giving the Division of Children, Youth and Families more power to intervene in questionable family situations. Just tell us what they're trying to do there.
Sure. So these reforms have really been prompted by two deaths in particular, one of a 3-year-old from Nashua, another from a 21-month-year-old from Manchester. And they both died, while their cases were under DCYF review. So that prompted a lot of, what can we do? How can we change this? How can we kind of intervene differently? So one of the things that was on the table was creating a round-the-clock staffing plan for DCYF. And this is interesting because, there's this thought that, right now the system is really only kind of functioning during a window of, I think, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. This would go 24/7. And obviously, you can see where there might be some gaps if there are things that happen outside of those hours. But what you're hearing from the department is that, they're already stretched really thin. This would create, a big burden for a department that is not, in their words, fully staffed. Now, the plan that's on the table, as reported by my coworker, Michael Brindley, this is a $1.8 million plan, and it would repurpose existing money to hire 18 new child protective workers to help to kind of cover those nights and weekends. But you're still hearing from people within DCYF saying that this is just, this is going to maybe potentially put more children in danger because we're going to be stretching ourselves even more thin than we already are. So
even with those 18 new people.
Yeah, that's kind of the comments that were coming forward at a hearing on that earlier this week. And then there are some other proposals on the table to kind of change the way that DCYF is able to conduct investigations and to alter the kind of emergency interim relief that they're able to provide in certain cases.
Gary, how surprising is it that DCYF is not staffed 24/7? I mean, a crisis in the home can happen anytime. Sunday morning, 2 o'clock on Thursday morning. I mean, it's just you just don't know.
Well, in for full disclosure, my wife is an elementary school guidance counselor, so I'm very well aware that it's not staffed after 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And I've seen her trying to get a hold of these people at after hours and so on. I mean, it's you get the government you pay for, and we don't want to spend money in New Hampshire that we don't have to, and that's fine. But we get into situations like this, and we don't have 24-hour coverage for people. And I mean, is it going to help? Well, maybe it won't help in an awful lot of cases, and maybe a lot of time people will be sitting around not doing anything. But the two or three times that it's really needed, then it's worthwhile to get people when you need people. Because a lot of this, I think what we're seeing is a lot more cases of child abuse. And again, I think it's tied into and speaking from talking to my wife, of course, there's a lot of drug problems and with people who have young kids, and it's starting to show. I mean, it's
so as addiction rises and mom is passed out, she can't take care of the toddler.
Yeah. So that's part of the problem of why we're seeing more and more and more of this, I think.
Casey, did you want to jump back in?
Yeah, just on a few things that Gary had mentioned, just in terms of the actual, the number of incidents the DCYF is having to handle. According to one caseworker that testified earlier this week, they're dealing with There was a 17-day span earlier this month where the Manchester DCYF office received 121 reports to investigate in a 17-day span. So that's a lot. And the man who testified said that the that's well over 20 reports per fully trained worker so far in that particular month. And 5 years ago, the average worker was receiving 12 reports a month. So that's up pretty substantially. And the other thing that's I think, you know, Gary touched on this just in terms of, you know, you get what you pay for. You did hear from lawmakers earlier this week, including Representative Joseph Guthrie of Hampstead, who was saying that, you know, we recognize that, yes, this is New Hampshire, but we have to spend money. He said, you know, I'm a pretty conservative Republican, but he couldn't see how anyone could justify not spending money on this particular investment. So,
well, the deaths of those two little kids mm-hmm. really shook people up. Mm-hmm. So this is a big story that I know NHPR is following and that we on the Exchange are looking at as well. We will set it aside for now and turn to a couple other headlines. I want to remind our listeners, though, that you can join us as well. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us as we cover some of the top stories around the Granite State this week. And there's been a lot to catch up on this week. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. And I wanted to turn, Dean Spiliotis, to the race on the Republican side for the first congressional district. This is, again, the district that covers the Lakes region, Manchester, the Seacoast. There's a pretty active primary on the Republican side. Several contenders must think, Dean, that sitting Congressman Frank Ginta is vulnerable. Just remind us why,
yeah.
Dean.
Well, yeah, Frank Ginta ran into trouble with the Federal Elections Commission dealing with some a campaign loan from his parents, and there was a lot of debate over, you know, whose money it actually was, and in the end, he's had to pay back that particular loan, and you know, sort of got a lot of a lot of negative reaction from other Republicans here in the state. He's marching ahead. He's running. You know, he's running again. You know, we'll see how he does with fundraising. And you know, the race had shaped up to be him, and then Pam Tucker is running as another state legislator who's running as a kind of a conservative sort of Tea Party style candidate. She got in. Dan Innes, who ran once before, the former business school dean at UNH. He got in, but now he just announced just in the last week or so that he was actually not going to run. He's backing out of the race to deal with other sort of personal business matters and other aspects of his career. So he won't be in the race. And now Rich Ashew, who is pretty well known here as someone who's flirted with running for political office before, has run at least once before, I believe, in a primary. A former BAE Systems government relations lobbyist, essentially, left BAE, had taken over as interim director of the Rudman Center at UNH Law. I believe he had a prior professional association with Senator Rudman from years ago. He took over. The thinking was he was going to do it for several months and then run, and that's exactly what's happened. UNH has named a permanent replacement, and he is now running for that first CD.
All right. Let's take a call, all of you. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477 to Whitefield. Daniel is on the air. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a DCYF child protection worker, so I was interested in your recent conversation regarding some of the possible changes for DCYF. And I wanted to kind of echo what one of the panelists said, that there's a lot of concern among workers about some unintended consequences of this move to a possible 24/7 system of covering the state. And also to point out that there is a system in place for calls that are received after hours, and typically law enforcement handles a lot of those. So I don't think it's the case that it's either 8 to 4:30 and then nothing exists, but rather
a different system kicks in.
You're dealing with a different agency at that point, but I've worked with a lot of police officers who are very clear on what their protocol is, whether or not it's their favorite thing to do.
Okay, so Daniel, thank you for calling in, saying that it's not the case that things are completely uncovered during those off times. It's good to hear from him, all of you, given that he works in this system. We'll talk more in just a moment. Thank you, Daniel, again for the call. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Gary, I did want to just hear from you very quickly after Daniel called from Whitefield saying he's a DCYF caseworker, having some concerns about moving the system to a 24/7, saying that police pick up the slack when DCYF caseworkers are not able to be on the job. Right. Just to wrap this up, Gary, if you could please. So this plan to staff DCYF 24/7 starts when, and is there an ending point?
Well, it's in the works right now. I mean, it's got to go through fiscal committee to get approval because that kind of money, you're moving that kind of money around. And it'll probably be up and running in a couple of months at least, maybe even sooner than that. And it goes through the rest of the biennium, which would be about another 14 months. And after that, it will have to be part of the budget process for the next biennium.
Okay. Well, again, Daniel, thank you for the call. And this is a story we are all keeping an eye on. I did want to turn to another story that grabbed huge headlines in New Hampshire for the past couple weeks. This is the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services talking to communities about water contamination. This week, DES discovered another 17 wells in and around Merrimack affected by a chemical called PFOA. And again, this has been an ongoing concern in the area. With us now on the line to tell us more is Matthew Metzger. He's a reporter for the Nashua Telegraph. He's been covering this story. Matthew, thank you very much for helping us out.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Well, just remind us, what is PFOA and why are people so worried about it, Matthew?
So I'll explain briefly, though it's very complicated. PFOA is a short way of saying perfluoroctanoic acid.
Okay, and better you than me, Matthew, yeah.
It's sometimes referred to as C8. It's a long-chain carbon molecule with 8 carbons in it. And it's a chemical that's been used since the 1940s as a surfactant. Surfactant is something that reduces the surface tension of materials contacting other materials, which is a fancy way of saying nonstick. So PFOA, or PFOA, has been used in Teflon frying pans, fast food wrappers, stain-proof carpeting, waterproof clothing, and even dental floss, just to name a few things.
So where is it coming from in this instance, Matthew?
So in its industrial use, the chemical is applied to products as its ammonium salt. They combine it with ammonia to cause it to turn into a thick paste. It's applied to a product and then burnt off, leaving either no or extremely small amounts of it left on the finished product. However, the chemical enters the atmosphere once it's burned and then falls back to the ground as contaminated rain. And that's how it's ending up in the drinking water.
I see. So we shouldn't worry when we floss our teeth, but if you are near one of these plants, there might be some in the drinking water. That's the concern.
Yeah, I mean, and the concerns with PFOA are really centered around its molecular structure. Its makeup is such that it doesn't readily bond or break down into other chemicals. This is, in fact, what gives it its nonstick properties. It also has the effect of limiting environmental degradation, meaning once that it's in the environment, there's very little that can be done to remove it, and it can be present almost indefinitely.
So the PFOA in question is coming from a plastics plant in Merrimack. Is that right,
yes,
Matthew? Yeah.
The plant in question, some of the older Granite State residents may remember there was a ChemFab facility there. But in the early 2000s, it was purchased by a French company called Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics. Saint-Gobain's been in the news a number of times recently over the same sort of story up in North Bennington, Vermont, in Hootsuite Falls, New York. They've discovered PFOA at unsafe levels above the EPA's recommended 400 parts per trillion safe short-term and health advisory limit. So it's a chemical used by those companies up until just recently. So as of 2015, the other companies that made and used this, including Saint-Gobain, Dow, and 3M, started to phase out the use of the chemical after they realized or after it became apparent that there was a probable link between PFOA and some serious diseases.
So Saint-Gobain is not using this anymore. Is that what you're saying, Matthew?
That is our understanding, at the very least. They've reported almost no emissions, no or zero, a negligible, unmeasurable amount, essentially, emissions of it from their plant or use of it at their plant, is my understanding. I can't say that for an absolute certainty. I don't know what the day-to-day operations there are. I do know that the chemical has not been made illegal. The phase-out was voluntary. And it can still be used in instances where there is no other chemical that can perform the same function. They've come up with a replacement, have some of the chemical giants in our country, that's essentially the same sort of molecule minus two carbons. Instead of having eight carbon atoms in it, it has six carbon atoms. And apparently this is to be taken as safer, but again, just like PFOA, all of these chemicals are fairly new as far as the human body and science, scientists' study of the medical effects on people. So it's hard to say what effects PFOA is going to have long term, but it's going to be around for a while, even if we have stopped using it. I've seen studies that say it can exist in the environment up to 17 years as its listed half-life, wow. Which means after 17 years, half of it has gone away, and then another 17, another half will have gone away. So small trace amounts of it will be around for a very long time, most likely.
And the concern about water, Matthew, isn't so much public water supplies, but more individual wells in that area in and around Merrimack. Is that correct?
Yes. So there was a small measured amount found in the Merrimack Village Water District. One well tested at 90 parts per trillion. Another, the current well in use, is my understanding, tested in the mid-50s. So those fall below the standard that the state of New Hampshire has chosen to use for long-term exposure, which is the 100 parts per trillion standard put forward by the state of Maine. They've tested 100, or I can't say actually they've tested, they received the results for 107 wells. I don't know how many they've tested altogether or who they've managed to get a hold of. But those testing was done between March 3rd and March 20th, and of the 107, 26 have shown levels of contaminant higher than the 100 parts per trillion mark being used by the state as its safe exposure limit. I need to stress, though, that the EPA has not yet released a nationwide lifetime advisory limit. They have released a short-term advisory limit of 400 parts per trillion, but they also define short-term exposure as exposure to something of less than 24 hours in a 30-day period. And clearly, you're drinking water is not a short-term exposure.
Yeah, you're with it all the time, aren't you?
Yes. So we're waiting. We're eagerly waiting the declaration by the EPA of what a lifetime exposure limit would be safe for our Granite State residents. But I've talked to epidemiologists, Professor Philippe Grandjean of the T.H. Chan Harvard, the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, told me that there are detrimental effects that can occur at as low as one part per trillion. So even a very little bit of this can be dangerous.
Well, Matthew,
that's a real concern.
Yeah, and I'm going to leave it there for now because we're going to do a program looking at this in more detail later next week. But thank you very much for helping us out with this. And good luck as you cover the story.
Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to being on in the future.
Okay, great. That's Matthew Metzger. He's a reporter for the Nashua Telegraph, again, covering concerns around the Merrimack area about drinking water quality. You can join us. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Another story that caught our attention, Dean, I'll turn to you first. This is from the Seacoast in Portsmouth. The police there are on a campaign to connect better with the public in that city. How come?
Yeah, they're doing a little bit of kind of a public relations outreach, trying to improve the image of the police force. I mean, there's sort of been a number of issues. One of the more high-profile ones was this former officer who managed to get a $2 million inheritance from an elderly individual that he befriended, and there's some evidence that the police force didn't sort of take it as seriously as they should have, and he's now been fired. But it's sort of just a general attempt in a number of different and kind of interesting ways to sort of make the police department more accessible and seem better in terms of outreach to the community. So, for example, they now have a community TV show in which they feature a different police officer each week. I believe the interim police chief there is Dave Marr, who used to be the Manchester police chief.
Widely praised.
Yeah,
for
and now they're in the
outreach
and they're
Manchester.
In the process of hiring a permanent one, but he's doing it for now. They have baseball trading cards featuring different
officers.
Well,
that's officers. What caught our attention.
That's
baseball
great,
trading
that's
cards.
A great idea. Baseball trading cards.
And if you collect them, you can win a prize. Yeah. If you collect all of them.
So they're doing that, and just trying to sort of, as I said, kind of a public relations facelift to the force, and this is something, is going on around the country. We've had a number of different issues with police forces around the country, and so you see a lot of these attempts to kind of sort of figure out how to better facilitate relations and understanding between the force and the community.
Well, one more story that I really wanted to catch up with you folks concerns a story we've talked about a lot, and this is the bobcat hunt continues to stir up debate at the State House. This week, opponents of the recently approved limited hunt released a 15-minute documentary film about the bobcat, very much against the hunt. Beautiful shots of New Hampshire. It made me want to jump in the car and go hiking right at that moment. What's the timing of the release, Gary Reyno, of this documentary? Why this week?
Well, today we have what's called the JLCAR, or Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules, is meeting on the very rules of the bobcat hunt. So that is why I'm sure that the documentary was released when it was, because this committee is today supposedly deciding whether they're going to send these people back to the drawing board, partially approve them, whatever. But they're having a public hearing on the rules. They're having it in the House of Representatives, Representatives Hall. They're expecting a huge crowd. The last time they had the public hearing when the Fish and Game was deciding this, it was in Representatives Hall, and there was about 600 people there.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But the Rules Committee has got some. I mean, they can't really stop the hunt, but they can delay it if they don't approve the rules. But they can't really stop it.
So usually this Rules Committee is very bureaucratic. It's just sort of, signing on the dotted
usually,
line and how are we going to do this.
It's usually like watching paint dry.
Coming from a longtime State House reporter. Dean, I got to get your thoughts
sure.
on this. A lot of the ire in this documentary is aimed at the Fish and Game Commission, not the department,
right.
but the commission. You hear the usual arguments. It's not necessary. It's a trophy
right.
hunt. There does seem to be this sort of disconnect with the commission that decided that this is okay and these huge numbers of people who are saying, no, this is not okay. It's like a culture clash.
Yeah, true. And there is this, as you alluded to, this sort of larger debate about whether or not this is even necessary. There's been some conflicting data. And so that has been one of the sort of big complaints of opponents is that this isn't really necessary, even though and granted, I believe it was a close vote on the commission. But nonetheless, it is moving forward. And I think Gary's point is important that this rules committee doesn't really substitute its own policy judgment. It's not a policy sort of deliberative policy body in the sense of the way the commission is coming up with this. But they can decide to delay if they're not happy with the rules. But yeah, this has been unusually contentious. I mean, it's not unusual to have. We've talked about these issues before. Whether baiting bears, I believe, or trapping, and so you do have these kinds of issues where there's very passionate feelings, and the hunting culture feels like the sort of conservation culture doesn't really understand their culture, and the committee is kind of stuck in the middle. So it's going to be fascinating to see what will likely be a big turnout today.
Well, it won't be like watching paint dry, probably, Gary. I did want to ask you, Casey, about another commission, a very different kind of commission. This is a commission that was proposed to study end-of-life issues. And again, this stirs up a lot of feelings as well. We did a whole program on this about a month ago. This bill has passed the Senate. It's headed to the House. And in a hearing this week on the House Judiciary Committee, there are a lot of people who said, you know, I really am having a hard time with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Monitor had a story about this earlier this week. And according to them, the hearing was 2 hours long. There were a lot of, you know, as you said, kind of passions on both sides. You had members of the religious community, you know, someone from the Roman Catholic Diocese of Manchester saying that, you know, in this instance, even creating a commission, which is really the proposal on the table, not necessarily making any policy changes, but it would send the message that suicide is worthy of study, that suicide has a place in our society. You have other people who are saying, well, you know, this provides kind of a, you know, death with dignity, an option for people who are really in a lot of pain, have exhausted other options and are making a conscious, informed decision to do, you know, to take control of their life in this way. But, you know, it stirred up a lot of, you know, a lot of debate. There are several other states, California, Vermont, Washington, Oregon, that have permitted various, you know, variations on kind of aid in dying or physician-assisted suicide. There are different ways of referring to it. And, you know, the proposal, as I mentioned, would establish a 13-member commission. It would include people from the legislature, physicians. It would include religious leaders and others who've also had an active voice in the discussion to just explore the issue and talk about it. And, you know, I think that the fact that it's stirred up so much debate, even just having – it's like a debate over having a debate really shows you just how sensitive the issue is and just how kind of personal and visceral it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, this bill is not saying let's establish a physician mm-hmm. aid in dying law. Let's just have a commission to talk about it. But even so, people felt like, no, we really shouldn't be discussing making suicide. Okay, that's their feeling.
And the commission would look at how to encourage careful and responsible deliberation of the issue, and they would report back to the legislature, you know, this year, and I believe in 2017 as well on those findings. So I think that this is, you know, a discussion that is not likely to be resolved anytime soon.
All right. Well, all of you, we always like to close out the show by finding out what you're going to be looking at next week. And I'll turn to you, Casey, first. What are you going to be covering?
So I don't know if I'll be covering this, but I'll be interested to see how the debate over the Supreme Court shapes up. It's my understanding that Merrick Garland.
This is the U.S.
Yeah,
Supreme
the U.S.
Court.
Supreme Court. You had Senator Shaheen calling for, you know, the Senate to take up that vote this week. You've had Senator Ayotte signaling that she will meet with the nominee. If not, you know, she hasn't signaled that she would be willing to take a vote on it yet. But just, you know, I think that the politics of that are interesting, and I'll
New
be
Hampshire
interested
repercussions.
To see.
Yeah. Gary, how about you?
Well, we have on Wednesday the Executive Council meeting, and one of their topics is going to be Mount Sunapee expansion.
Oh, my goodness. So, yes, that's a big one. And two out of the five running for governor. So
yeah, two of them are running for governor, so it will be a very interesting vote.
Okay, so we'll expect you to be there, and we'll look forward to what you write about that. Gary, how about you, Dean? What are you up to?
I'm looking forward to that vote as well. You know, it's amazing with this sort of big governor's race now with seven candidates. The Senate race is already totally fired up over the Supreme Court nomination. It makes the presidential primary almost feel like a distant memory. We've got so much statewide politics going on now. It's just a great time to study it, and so I'm going to be watching it all develop.
All right. All of you, thank you so much for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.